You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Violence stemming from paramilitaries and drugs has burdened Colombia for decades. It has hindered the development of stable state institutions. It has led to the death of countless public-spirited civilians. The Uribe government took office with a promise to tackle this problem. It was a hollow promise, according to Jasmine Ristoff. She argues that the war on drugs and other reforms are largely cosmetic. They're intended to hide a far more sordid reality: paramilitaries, local elites, and the state that are deeply intertwined. Jasmine Ristoff is the author of the forthcoming book, Blood and Capital. She's joined me by phone from Toronto. Good morning, Jasmine.
Good morning, Peter.
What's the nature of the connection between the state and these paramilitary gangs?
Okay, the connection between the state and the paramilitary in Colombia has been a long-standing one. So in order to understand how profound it is, we need to actually look at the origin of paramilitary groups in Colombia to have an idea then how has this relationship evolved throughout the years and what is its nature today. So if we look at how paramilitary groups originated, we can identify two phases in their origin. The first was in the 1960s, when they merged as a product of the joint counterinsurgency efforts of the Colombian and U.S. administrations, or what was known as the War on Communism. So these paramilitary groups were created to assist the state in its combat of the guerrilla and to also gather intelligence for the state. And the targets were not only the guerrilla, but they were also leftist political organizations, other social movements, labor unions, the educational sector, basically anyone who was seen as a potential guerrilla collaborator. And they were regarded as what is known as the internal enemy. And this actually hasn't changed until today. And at that time, in 1968, there was a law that came into effect, and this law was very important because it laid the legal foundation for the establishment of paramilitarism in Colombia by authorizing the executive branch to create these groups and to supply them with weapons that were normally restricted only to the armed forces of Colombia. So this was a very important moment. And later on, even though in 1989 the law was abolished, paramilitarism was abolished legally, it continued in reality. Because in the 1980s, already the capitalist class of Colombia had taken a direct role in creating their own paramilitary groups. And they called them at that time self-defense. So this I call the second phase of paramilitary creation, where the elite took a more direct role, but the state nevertheless tolerated and assisted the creation of these groups. And when I say the elite, I'm referring to the large-scale landowners, the cattle ranchers, the mining entrepreneurs, the narco-traffickers, industrialists, and some foreign companies.
I was just going to say, so obviously the elites benefit from these paramilitary activities. What's the actual connection with the state? Is there a direct connection between the paramilitaries and the state?
Yes. So the connection is that the state, as I said, has always supported throughout all these years, from the 1960s when it first created them directly, but even later on, it has always tolerated and supported and assisted these groups. But this has always been underground. In other words, this connection has never been acknowledged. And this connection continues until today even. But it is never acknowledged. It is portrayed as, a few corrupt officials here and there, few bad apples, in other words. But what is not recognized is that the penetration of paramilitarism into the Colombian state is actually a systemic feature of that state. It's we're talking about the penetration of major state institutions. So all of the institutions in the military, the justice system, the political system, and even if we look at the president Uribe himself, the connections are visible. And now more and more evidence has come out in Colombia pointing to these various connections. Nevertheless, the fact that they're revealed doesn't mean that they will end.
So you mentioned the military a few seconds ago. What's the relation between the Colombian military and the paramilitary forces?
Sure. So the Colombian military has for a long time provided uniforms, weapons, training spaces, transportation, and other equipment to these groups. Their non-intervention, or in other words, their failure to intervene to protect civilians from paramilitary activities has also been one of the ways in which they have basically assisted them indirectly. They have also assisted them directly through the provision of security, or what they call security rings. So if, for example, a paramilitary group is going to carry out certain activities, often massacres or other forms of human rights violation in a given area, the military have provided a wider security ring that would ensure that no one else would enter or access the zone where the paramilitary activity is happening. And there have even been joint operations where members of the armed forces together have participated side by side with paramilitary combatants in the performance of massacres and other forms of human rights violations, such as in the case of San Jose de Apartado, the massacre there. And the last important way in which there is a connection is the exchange of intelligence between the two. So, for example, recently it became public the news that the former director of DAS, which is the intelligence department, basically, of the armed forces, the former director of DAS, Jorge Noguera, provided paramilitary commanders with information about union leaders. And later on, these union leaders appeared executed. So it's many ways in which this connection manifests itself. And often it is paramilitary groups that provide lucrative opportunities for members of the state forces to participate and benefit themselves financially while using their authority, and thus allow for the activities of paramilitary groups to take place.
How's the Colombian justice system dealt with this issue of paramilitary gangs?
So the Colombian justice system has not been able to deal with this issue in the way you're probably imagining us to bring about justice, because the justice system itself has been deeply penetrated by paramilitary power as well. And when I say paramilitary power, I'm referring to the power of elite groups that use violence in order to enrich themselves, to accumulate capital, because that is the ultimate purpose of the use of violence in Colombia. So the justice system has not been an exception, and it is evident in the fact that the 97% of human rights abuses remain unpunished. So this impunity actually speaks of the criminality of the state. And so, for example, let me give you some examples of how the justice system has been penetrated. It is either members of the Fiscalía, which is the public prosecutor's office, or judges, or any other individuals who you would associate with the justice system, either they are threatened by the violence of paramilitary groups and are therefore forced to cooperate, or are otherwise eliminated or killed, or on the other hand, they choose to cooperate because they benefit financially from it. So the ways in which they cooperate is, for example, they actually take part in the operations of paramilitary forces. They assist them because they have experience, they have the authority, or they would declare cases closed due to the lack of evidence. They would disappear evidence. They would intimidate or eliminate witnesses in exchange for rewards, and so on.
What's the nature of the Uribe's government's awareness of all these connections between the elites, the military, the judiciary, and the paramilitaries?
Well, Uribe is very aware of it because if we look at Uribe and his family, Uribe himself has connections to the paramilitary, and these have been well documented, actually. So just to give you a few examples of what are these connections to the paramilitary and drug trafficking, which is basically the same thing, because most paramilitaries are involved in drug trafficking. So, for example, when he was director of the Department of Civil Aviation before he became president, he used to authorize licenses to drug traffickers such as Pablo Escobar for aircrafts that were transporting drugs to the United States. Uribe's father himself was a known landowner and drug trafficker of the Medellin cartel. A document that was produced by the Pentagon in 1991 listed Uribe as among the important Colombian narco-terrorists from the Medellin cartel. One of Uribe's properties has served as the headquarters for a paramilitary group. As well, Uribe's brother Santiago has had connections with paramilitary groups, and his hacienda was also the headquarters for the group known as the 12 Apostles. Further on, we come to 2002, during his electoral campaign, he received funding from Enilce López, who was a woman who used to control gambling establishments belonging to the paramilitary. Hmm. And finally, just this year, in 2008, former Senator Mario Uribe, who is also the president's second cousin and close political ally, was charged with having links with paramilitary groups. So that is Uribe himself. But apart from that, in early 2007, a flood of revelations came out that gave rise to a phenomenon known as the parapolitica or parapolitics. And this means connections between paramilitaries and important politicians, senators, parliamentarians, councillors, deputies, mayors, and so on. And these are connections in which the politicians and paramilitaries were mutually advancing their interests. In mid 2008, statistics from this year indicate that 38% of Congress members have been implicated in this parapolitica scandal.
That's extraordinary.
And among them is the Vice President, Francisco Santos, and Colombia's Minister of Defense, Juan Manuel Santos.
That's amazing. Now, what about foreign companies? How have foreign companies benefited from paramilitary violence in Colombia?
Sure. So there is a number of U.S. companies that have about which there is already evidence that they have had connections with paramilitary companies, and it is important to recognize what is the role that violence has played in Colombia in order to see how it applies to the case of foreign companies. Violence plays two major purposes. One is to dispossess, the other is to suppress. Dispossess, I'm talking about dispossessing the low-income population through forced displacement. And what is accomplished as a result of that? Guaranteeing access to resources, right, natural resources, and ensuring a favorable environment for economic exploitation, because you have more and more people who are landless, they have no means of subsistence, so that constitutes a constantly expanding pool of wage laborers, basically willing to work at any price in order to survive. This is the dispossession part. And to suppress is the other major purpose that violence has played, and I'm referring here to suppressing or eliminating popular organizing, attacking social movements in order to intimidate them, in order to prevent them from building an alternative economic model that's based on social justice and equality. So in the case of foreign companies, and it's important to know here that, again, local capital is also very important. So local capital has benefited, but foreign companies have also benefited from the displacement strategies of paramilitary groups. And there has been a very high degree of correspondence between areas where forced displacement provoked by paramilitary groups occurs and areas that have active mining and resource exploration by foreign enterprises. So let me give you some examples. In the Uraba region of the Department of Antioquia, there have been African palm oil companies that have been appropriating the land that has been abandoned by the residents who were fleeing the paramilitary terror. In Colombia, there are around 4 million internally displaced people. And as far as I know, it is the second country in the world after Sudan with internally displaced population. Only last year, 305,000 people were displaced.
In your book, do you offer any way out of this sort of cycle of paramilitary violence?
Well, I don't offer a way out because I consider this book as the first step towards contributing to a transformation. And the first step is to understand really where power comes from, because power is very well invisibilized in Colombia through various strict ideological, legal, and so on. It is important to visualize it to show what makes the powerful powerful, actually. How does it function? So I consider it, you know, as a way of looking at the mechanisms that sustain this machinery of terror. And it's important to understand these. Then if we know them, if we identify them, then the second step would be how to take action against them.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to explain the situation there to us this morning. I really appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.
I've been talking with Jasmine Ristoff. She's a PhD candidate in sociology at York University. She's also the author of the forthcoming book, Blood and Capital, The Paramilitarization of Colombia. For more information on that book, you can go to ohioswallow.com.